All right, welcome to episode 4 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I am Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today we're going to be talking to Robert Carl, who is assistant professor of history at Princeton University. So, Robert, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So we all know you're paying attention to Latin America at all. The bombshell yesterday was the referendum for the Colombian peace agreement was voted down by the teeniest, tiniest of margins. We're talking in the tens of thousands of votes, you know, out of some 13 million that were cast. Everybody right now is trying to figure out what went wrong. And, you know, what's the campaign and, Uribe's, former president Uribe's role, all this stuff. And so what I want to do is take a broader look, broader historical look. And, Robert had, posted at the Monkey Cage, which I'm glad to see too. They put in some political history. It's not just political science. So, we get that broader view, but you argued that, some of this is not new, that this dates back to historical trends in Colombia of fear of independent republics popping up and it seeming like there is this constant split between the state and outlying areas or urban versus rural. So can you just walk me through what that main argument is?
Sure. My pleasure. Really, since the beginning of the 20th century, Colombian political elites have expressed a concern about the state's ability to control the national territory. So actually, one of the earliest instances that we see this is the conservative president Laureano Gómez, early in his political career, around 1910, denouncing the recently seceded Colombian territory of Panama as a little republic. And his son, then 50 years later, the most famous instance of this pattern of concern over territorial control, his son is an opposition senator in late 1961, denounces as independent republics these frontier community zones. And by frontier, I don't mean they're up on the border with Venezuela, down by the border with Ecuador, or with Brazil. We're talking about an internal colonization frontier. So sort of like the Old West, a Wild West situation. So areas of Colombia where you have virgin forest, settlers back then, you know, early to mid 20th century, they'd be growing coffee. Today, they'd more likely be growing coca. They're moving out into these frontiers. They're, sort of homesteading, laying claim to these state owned lands, maybe, eventually acquiring a formal ownership of them. And just given the Cold War environment of the moment, so late 1961, we're fewer than 3 years out from Fidel Castro's triumph in the Cuban Revolution, the prospect of these frontier communities, particularly ones that are aligned with the Colombian Communist Party, they become a really big fear. And this motif of the independent republic has endured in some form. If not even in direct form, in sort of Colombian political speech, Colombian political thought, over the last, 55 years now.
But so here's one thing that confuses me. If there's, we know right now that there's big chunks of Colombia that the state barely inhabits. Like that's already happening. So how is it that in the context of the peace agreement, there's this assumption or fear that it would get worse?
Right. Well, part of it is a concern that the FARC, in transitioning from an armed guerrilla movement to a peaceful political movement, would, you know, be able to come out of the open and sort of cement that control, that they would receive legitimation through the political process and, you know, could possibly be able to sort of take any state resources that are being directed from the capital out to these very remote areas, and strengthen their hold in that way. And potentially, so the argument goes, if we want to look at the people who are using the language or at least the logic of the independent republics, that the FARC or whatever its political successor is would use those areas then to subvert Colombia's constitutional democracy.
And is that something, because until I had read your piece, I hadn't really thought in these terms. Is that something that Uribe, Pastrana, and others are openly talking about is like a coded language, or that is, has that been pretty much out there in the open?
I looked to see if you could see some instances of the Independent Republic, like actual direct quotes where people are using Independent Republic. You see a little bit around, a little bit of usage around this figure of the Peasant Reserve Zone, which was an institution set up by a 1994 agrarian reform law that's intended to give peasant farmers protection through the state. So sort of guarantee their access to land, sort of both a minimum of land so that they can be productive, and also to protect them against land grabs by large farmers. So these areas are you know, there's special rules. They have, I wouldn't quite call them self-governance, institutions for self-governance, but they do give local people more of a role, I think, in sort of local political life broadly defined. Uribe, as president early in his first term in 2003, froze the creation of these zones. So the law was in force for just under a decade. There's been a lot of mobilization and calls at the local level in some different areas for the expansion or for the creation of new peasant reserve zones. And you do see elements of the opposition from Uribe's party, sort of similar political movements with similar political ideologies. You do see them talking about independent republics. With Uribe, the term that's really been prominent in the campaign against the peace accords, although I think it's faded in recent weeks, is this idea of Castrochavismo. So the idea that this is going to turn the peace accords are going to enable the FARC to turn Colombia into a socialist country along the lines of Venezuela or Cuba. So it's not precisely the language of the independent republic, but again, it's part of the logic of that. This fear of the territorial disillusion of Colombia as a country, and particular emphasis on those foreign influences. Again, 1961, we might have been talking about the Soviet Union or Cuba. Today it's going to be either Cuba or Venezuela. And it's very interesting that this term Castrochavismo, Uribe started using it precisely late 2012 or early 2013. So within the first few months of the start of these negotiations.
And what's funny to me is that the FARC has increasingly moved away from that kind of language. I mean, I guess they can figure that they're lying. But if you're fighting an insurgency, well, then that's like Cuba. As soon as you argue that you want to stop fighting the insurgency, it's kind of hard to argue that they're going to try to make Colombia into Cuba, because they're actually giving up the possibility of even making that happen. I'm not saying that logic has anything to do with this particular debate, but
no, I see that too. But I do think you see sort of the reflection of a different Cold War logic, which is this idea that we'll. Even if they don't have guns, communists are tricky.
Yeah.
And the Cuban Revolution showed us that with only a few dozen men, you can overthrow a government. You can defeat its military. So I think that sort of logic that, you know, there may not be a lot of them, but they're subversive in a lot of different clever ways. They've got this backing from abroad. That's something we still see.
So, and thinking about the peasant reserves, do you think, is this sort of connected to Cold War era or even before, simple fear of land reform? Fear that these peasants are somehow going to take land that ought to belong to somebody else? Is there any sort of, because I know that in the past, land reform be used as an example of sort of communist dupes trying to take land from capitalists. Is there any of that now?
Well, absolutely. And I think that was one of the big concerns that Uribe's political party raised. It was that the accords were going to undermine the basic institution of private property in Colombia. And that was something the government said wasn't on the table, that Colombia's capitalist economic model wasn't going to change. So you had this back and forth between the government saying, no, this isn't on the table, and the opposition to the negotiations saying, you know, this is going to be one of the fundamental ways in which Castrochavismo expresses itself is by sort of abolishing the institution of private property. What's interesting, though, a couple things. First of all, you know, this is sort of referred, the FARC come across as rather moderate in what they agreed to in the Accords. We're not talking about the seizure by the state, the nationalization of properties, the redistribution to peasants. There are provisions in the Accords for a national land bank that's going to be a combination of land seized from either right-wing paramilitary groups or from drug cartels, combination of these, frontier lands that haven't yet been titled to individual farmers and so on. And there was some discussion, I think, among the opposition that land bank, you were going to see the guarantees to private land ownership. So it's not quite as far as saying, well, they're going to abolish private property altogether, but it's sort of an intermediate step. The other interesting point here, though, is that even as the government's been conducting these negotiations, which again, really give more emphasis to the peasant reserve zones, revive this 20-something-year-old law, which has antecedents in earlier colonial laws dating back into the 20th century, deeper into the 20th century. Even as the government has been making these provisions to protect small farmers, it also passed, I think, on its third try through Congress. It's been a very controversial bill. A bill that would open up Colombia's last, again, one of these internal agricultural frontiers up on what's called the Llanura, so on sort of the Orinoco region stretching north towards Venezuela, that was going to allow for big agribusiness interests to consolidate land holdings. It was going to overcome some of the restrictions around private property, so, you know, the threshold above which landowners that you couldn't own any more land. This law, which just passed a few months ago, was really the Santos's administration's attempt to recreate the Brazilian export boom of, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago on Colombia's last frontier. So even within the government, you've got these two tendencies, and that was something I had wondered about, you know, how this would play out if the Peace Accord had passed with its ostensible commitment to small peasant farmers versus the government introducing these new incentives for large-scale agribusiness.
Right, right. That is a tension. And I love too, in the just thinking about how Colombians in urban areas view the countryside, or how even connected they are. You were noting about how there were protests in upscale malls. So you got basically rich Colombians saying, you know, you got to vote for the no. Do they have any knowledge at all what's going on in the countryside? I mean, is there just an absolute abyss between the urban and rural populations in Colombia when it comes to figuring out how in the world you're going to move forward and make the state work effectively in the whole country?
No, that's a great question. And this is one of the issues I take up in my forthcoming book. It's one of the central themes. So
plug away, absolutely plug.
Plug away, right. So the book is Forgotten Peace, Reform Violence, and the Making of Contemporary Colombia. It's coming out in the spring with the University of California Press as part of its new series on violence in Latin American history. So the book, it ends actually with the origins of the FARC. But what it deals with is looking at the prior roughly decade from 1957, when Colombia's military dictatorship ended, up until more or less 1966, which is not just the year in which the FARC takes the name FARC. There are several other processes going on in Colombian politics, Colombian society. But I recast these years as fundamentally ones of peace, where you have a lot of efforts by not just politicians, officials in the state, but also rural peoples to sort of think about what violence in Colombia has been. So this is a moment in which Colombia is emerging out of La Violencia, as the civil war of the 1940s to the 1950s was known. We're talking about debates about this at the time. You know, we say today 200,000 people died in this decade plus from the mid-40s to the late 50s. So this made it Latin America's worst conflict in mid-century, worst civil war in mid-century. But what I'm saying, you know, we have this sort of exceptional moment of violence or 10 years of violence in Colombia, but we also have some really unprecedented peace-building efforts in the late 50s and 60s that in terms of issuing a political pardon for people who had taken up arms against the government or taken up arms to defend themselves in the 40s and 50s, efforts to return displaced Colombians to their lands or to resettle them on the frontiers, really a lot of precedents that have gone sort of, as I say, it's a forgotten piece, that have gone unremembered in Colombian, both historical writing and in the broader in the broader imagination. So that's the plug for the book. And I actually forget now what the question.
Okay.
We got onto this.
The urban-rural divide.
Oh, right, right. So, sorry. That's one of the central themes of the book, is looking at how urban and rural Colombians came together, had encounters over the issues of peace and violence. Now, on the one hand, I don't want to play up, or I have a hesitancy, I should say, to really talk about this urban-rural divide, because it's a very well-established trope in sort of Latin American studies. But on the other hand, I really think it's true. And at the very least, the Colombians in the 1950s and 60s believed it was true. Now, fast forward these last 50 years, I do think that urban Colombians have lost a lot of the common ancestral ties to the rural areas that Colombians might have had 50 years ago. So it's only in the 1960s that Colombia becomes a majority urban country. So we're talking people who are, you know, only one generation, maybe two generations removed from the countryside. Now we've had several generations who may have grown up in a city like Bogota or Medellin. So I think some of that shared cultural regional background has faded. You know, frankly, these have also been war zones. It's been very hard for Colombian and international news outlets to get into some of these areas. And then if you do, you do still see a lot of the reflection of older ways of thinking about the countryside. So again, the figure of the independent republics, the thought that that the FARC are this sort of radical Marxist Leninist group, which is very often how they presented itself. But as I argue in the article, there's a different history there, that the FARC have a peasant base who's rather moderate, requests for reform and also sort of the basic measures of political citizenship really come across in the accords that were reached in late August.
Okay, and so I want to follow up on one point that I hadn't really thought so much of before, and that is so La Violencia ends with a power sharing agreement, and you get people who hated each other and were shooting at each other at the negotiating table to come up with what I assume was something that was extremely unpalatable to a lot of them. So there's precedent on a pretty important scale of this sort of thing being done before. Is that just kind of out of the national consciousness now?
You do have a lot. You've had a lot of discussion over the last few weeks that this is the second plebiscite in Colombia's history, this referendum vote on the peace accords on October 2nd. The first one happened in December 1957, precisely, as you say, to bring around, on the one hand, an end to the partisan warfare that comprised most of La Violencia. But then also it was an attempt to restore Colombia's democracy, as the dictatorship had been overthrown about 7 months, beforehand. But this is a moment actually where we can read the urban-rural divide in a different way. These peace negotiations the last 4 years between the Santos administration and the FARC in Havana, have been between a government and a rural belligerent. Whereas the accords that in some ways brought an end to La Violencia, these were negotiated exclusively by urban politicians.
Okay.
And actually, the bases for them were reached in Spain, because one of the former presidents, actually Laureano Gómez, the same one who had denounced Panama as an independent republic half a century earlier, he had been exiled to Spain by the military government that had deposed him in 1953. So to the extent that the 1950s and the end of La Violencia are remembered today, it's in reference to this plebiscite and this elite political pact. It's actually misremembered in a number of ways. What you don't see talked about hardly at all are the kinds of programs, the kinds of initiatives that I talk about in my book. So again, returning displaced Colombians to their lands, some what look to us now like early truth and reconciliation efforts, and so on. And those are not just driven from Bogota and the other, the departmental, the provincial capitals in Colombia. That's really sort of in some ways, the capitals, the political response to bottom-up pressure. rural Colombians coming out and saying, well, this is what our experience was during La Violencia. These are what our needs are. So in some ways, it was a much more organic process than what you see today. We're talking about in the late 1950s. We don't have, you know, generations of international experts on conflict resolution. So it's a much more organic process. I write in the book that there's no real formal peace process in the 1950s. That peace itself was the process.
Okay. Now, I know nothing at all about the vote. How broad was the voting? I mean, how was it mostly elite? Or I know nothing at all about it. Just who was voting?
In 1957?
Yeah. Who's eligible?
Right. Well, so this was interesting. It's actually the first time women in Colombia had been allowed to vote.
Ah.
They had been granted it, oddly enough, under the dictatorship, but then there were no elections for the intervening years. So it's funny, you have the president or the man who would become president, or the architect of this National Front Pact that brought an end to La Violencia, his saying, you know, this is the largest voter turnout we've ever had in Colombia. Well, it's no kidding. You have theoretically twice as many voters because women are allowed to vote now. You know, one of the things that gets bandied around, or has been bandied around since yesterday, is the low voter turnout. So 30-something, under 40%. The plebiscite in 1957 was the highest percentage of eligible voters voting in Colombian history. And something like 90-something percent of them approved the referendum.
Wow. 'Cause one of the things that has also been discussed, particularly today, is, you know, should such peace agreements be subject to national referenda? You know, because that's not always the case in Central American peace accords. So I didn't actually know that it was capped off, that a lot of the violence in the 1950s, the discussion was capped off by a vote that received a high level of participation. There's in Colombia, they've done it.
Yeah, although the political contexts are very, very different. And I want to emphasize this again, that in the 1950s, we're talking about a period of democratic transition coming out of a military dictatorship.
Right.
Contrast that to now, you know, there's not a new constitution on the table. You know, the FARC demanded that for a long time. They said that when the peace process ends, we want a constitutional convention to ratify a new national charter. And the government said that that was never on the table. So FARC came around to accepting the referendum is one of the possible options for ratification. But on the other hand, as you say, this was a very odd thing. And it was really just like David Cameron and Brexit. This was an ill-calculated move by Santos strictly to sort of drum up the political capital that he thought he'd need to move the reforms forward once the peace process was concluded. So constitutionally, legally, he had no responsibility or obligation to have Colombia vote in a referendum.
And I guess one of the big differences from before was that because of the context of democratic transition, all the parties involved had some sort of, if not common enemy, then common goal of change, which right now is absent. Though it's funny you say that it was ill-calculated. It came within a very short, very small number of votes of everybody congratulating Santos for what a wonderful job he did shepherding this through. So
no, it's really extraordinary. You know, you started off asking me about the deep political context or the deep historical context of the vote, and I'm really struck as a historian just the importance of contingency. So if there hadn't been this hurricane that, you know, hit a glancing blow against the Caribbean coast,
that too,
very heavy rains, you know, we might not be having this conversation today. So the margin was really extraordinary. I was watching the returns come in last night on Colombian government websites, and with 83% of the vote counted, 10.5 million ballots, there were 700 votes difference.
Yeah.
It was really extraordinary. And then if you, as you said, we're talking about tens of thousands, just somewhere just over 50,000 votes of difference in the final tally. If you looked at just the number of nullified or blank ballots cast in Bogota, it's about half that figure.
Huh.
So I'm not necessarily saying, you know, if these people who didn't vote or sort of cast blank votes as protest or purposefully disqualified their ballots by marking them wrong, you know, I'm not saying if more of those people had voted differently, we would have seen a different outcome, but it does really highlight just how thin this margin of difference was.
All right. Well, we are out of time. So thank you so much for doing this. This is Robert Carl, who's assistant professor of history at Princeton. And don't forget, he has a forthcoming book, what, next year on, basically this, okay, tell me again, what's the core argument? Is the core argument basically the monkey cage article, more or less?
In some ways, it's really pushing us to rethink how we think about Columbia.
Okay. Well, that's what historians are supposed to do, right?
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you again.